On March 25th, 1942, 997 young, mainly middle-class women boarded a train in Slovakia. They'd been told to report to central locations in the country's east to sign up for what was described as government service. The women were unmarried and they were Jewish. Their journey would be the first Jewish transport to Auschwitz after their sale by the Slovakian government to Nazi Germany for 500 Reichsmarks. The previously untold story of the women is recounted in Heather Dune McAdam's book 999, The Extraordinary Young Women of the First Official Jewish Transport to Auschwitz. The book builds on an earlier work, Rina's Promise, in which she helped write with Rina Kornreich-Gleason, who was on that first transport and survived 341 days in Auschwitz. The 999 is also the subject, or are also the subject, of a documentary currently in post-production. Heather Dune McAdam is with us from New York City. Welcome, Heather.
Hi.
Lovely to have you with us. Thank you very much. 999 is the latest book, but would you mind if we started first with Rina's Promise? This was a book you co-wrote with Rina Kornreich-Gleason about her experiences of being rounded up and forced onto the first Jewish transport of women to Auschwitz. What an extraordinary woman. How did you come to meet her?
I lived in North Carolina at the time, and Rina was an avid tennis player, and a friend of mine owned a tennis club. And Rina was a very big talker, and one day she called my friend by accident, and once Rina gets on the phone, you really can't get her off. It's not easy. She talks super fast. And suddenly she was telling my friend, Corinne, all about her story in Auschwitz. And Corinne said, you should really write a book. And Rina said, well, I need somebody with kind eyes. And Corinne said, I know just the person. And that was me.
So you forged something of a friendship. Yes.
We met each other and fell madly in love with each other. In fact, the second book, 999, I met another survivor who was in her 90s at the time, and they were very similar women, very energetic, super high powered, really positive, super funny, and the moment I met them, I just had this deep, deep link. And we were, I was best friends with Rina to the day she died, and I was best friends with Edith. She passed away in July last year, and I spoke to her. I couldn't see her because of COVID, but I was on the phone with her 48 hours before she passed away.
You've done a tremendous amount of research for this. You've uncovered new information, but those personal relationships, it's hard to go past knowing and sitting beside and talking to anyone who's been through something like this. Could you tell us a little more about Rina's story first and exactly what happened with the sale of people? Tell me a little bit more about her young life first.
Well, this is interesting. So Rina's story is different than Edith's. Sorry, that's a little back. One of my neighbors is motorcycling past. Rina was hiding in Slovakia. She had slipped across the border from Poland, where it was much worse, and Slovakia had, the Jews had more rights, and it was safer. So she was hiding there and had been there probably about a year and a half before the first transport was, the orders for the first transport were made by the Slovak government. And none of the girls, nobody, in fact, nobody knew that the Slovak government was paying the Nazi Germany to take the girls and, in fact, to take their Jews. That the Slovak government, their agreement was to pay 500 Reichmark per Jew for the Nazis to take them away on the agreement that the Jews would never return. And they called this rehoming. Lovely word, euphemism. And so that did not become unearthed until after the war. And the lie was, you know, you're going to go to work and you're going to go probably a shoe factory. Slovakia at that point had a very large shoe factory. They made army boots. There was a war on. And they told parents that the girls were going to go just for 3 months. And the first four transports to Auschwitz were all young women, and they all thought they were going to be back in 3 months and they were going to go home. And of course, that never happened. Rina is on this transport. She's one of very few Polish Jews that is on the transport. I know of actually six girls that were Polish on the transport. There are probably more, but I know of six, and who were hiding. They were from border towns. So they, Rina and her sister had slipped across the border, and they were illegal immigrants. So part of the reason that Rina ends up on the transport is she turns herself in as an illegal alien because she's hiding with a family, and she knows if they get caught that they could be executed.
She's extraordinary, isn't it? She sacrifices herself.
She volunteers.
Yeah, she's extraordinary.
She volunteers.
And then I think Danka eventually followed her sister, didn't she?
Yep. Danka was on the second transport, which arrived in Auschwitz two days later.
So just staying with her story before we come to Edith, how did she survive those 341 days, the woman she was?
This is 3 years and 41 days. So these girls, if they survive, they survive from March 26th, they arrive in Auschwitz on March 26th, 1942, until the end of the war.
Goodness.
And that, for Rina, that was May 2nd, 1945. That was the same for Edith. If you were in Auschwitz on January 18th, 26th, 1945, then you were liberated then. Some of the survivors were liberated from Bergen-Belsen in April. It really depends where you were in terms of when you were liberated. But all of these young women were in death camps for over 3 years. And the way they survived, first of all, there's no pat answer. There's a lot of luck. You had to have your health. But I think a lot of them, they had relationships with friends and family that Rina certainly depended on her sister. The two of them had a deep bond. Edith, on the other hand, lost her sister and very nearly doesn't survive. But she's adopted by a dear friend who becomes her lager sister. And all of these young women speak about their sisterhood, whether it's an adopted sister or a flesh and blood sister. Sisterhood is what helped you survive. And you might lose your sister, but somebody else would come along and fill that gap. And especially the girls that were there from that very beginning who came in, they recognized each other and they knew each other by, within a few months, they could look at each other and go, oh, I know you, we were on the same transport together. They didn't know each other when they arrived, but so many of them died within those first few months. I think one of my survivors said that probably by the end of 1942, which is in December, there were maybe 300 left. I don't know how many survived. Their survival rate was greatly increased because one of the SS women, who was quite notorious and evil, decided that anybody with a four-digit number, any young woman who had a four-digit number, they would not gas them unless they were ill. So they wouldn't be selected. And Rina would say when they were in selections that the SS would look at her number and point at it and be in awe that she had a number that was 1,716. That's a four-digit number. By the end of 1942, their women are being numbered in 28,000. 1943, they're in the 40,000s. Men, by the end of 1942, are already in 100,000. That's that's how many human beings were going through Auschwitz at this point. And being tattooed means you're getting registered in camp. It doesn't mean if you arrived in camp and you went straight to the gas, you didn't get a tattoo. Those aren't numbered. the people that come into camp as slave labor are the ones that get tattoos.
Tell me a little bit about Edith Grossman, of whom we're speaking, the other survivor with whom you got to know so well and who told her story. And we should say the significance of that first book you published with Rena, I've seen it quoted as one of the most important books written on the women's camp in Auschwitz. Historically accurate, very important record. And tell me a little of Edith then, and, you know, who were these young women at this time? Like, what did she know about where she was going and what was happening? They were just young women, teenagers.
Nothing. Edith is 17. Rena was 22. So she was a little bit, a little bit older, a little bit wiser. Edith was a kid. And Edith... Edith has a, she makes an amazing comment that she said it, it was really like a light bulb. She said, we were teenagers, we had temper tantrums and we were lazy and we didn't want to get up and we were moody and, and we were in Auschwitz, really not a great place to be a teenager. And you couldn't rebel because you would die. So it is, Edith is with her sister who is 19 and with a bunch of her friends. And this is what was so extraordinary to me when I met Edith. Edith grew up in the same town that Rena was hiding in. So they had to have known each other in synagogue. They were in different circles because they were older teenage girls versus young women who are hoping to get married soon. But they would have recognized each other. And Edith is, she goes to Auschwitz with her childhood friends. Rena does as well because they're hiding from Poland. But there's a high school class Edith's class, and there are 8 Jewish girls in the class. And of those girls, there are only 3 survivors. And of those 3, only one went to Auschwitz, and that was Edith. The fact that she does survive is quite extraordinary. That she is with so many young women that she has grown up with that are on her street. And that's quite extraordinary because they do help each other. And, I want to say best friend. It's not a best friend. Her parents, the parents had a fight. And so the parents didn't talk to each other. But Monsi Becker, who we call Margie Becker in the book, sneaks Edith's shoes because Edith's shoes break. And she said, even though our parents wouldn't speak to each other, Margie Becker saved my life. That's the kind of that's the kind of neighbors that these young women were. That's how they grew up, taking care of each other.
So you had these vital firsthand accounts from survivors, but you do a lot of other research. You go through the archives. What else do you learn, Heather?
Well, I tell you, I thought I knew a lot about the transport, and then I found so much more in the Slovak National Archives, and I met historians. Because Slovakia was behind the Iron Curtain for so long, a lot of their history didn't really become easily available to us until the 1990s. And with the internet, it became much easier. When I wrote Rena's Promise, the only resources I had, it was the early 90s, were archives and libraries. And so 999 I had the USC Shoah Foundation archives. I had many more testimonies. I also, one of the most amazing things for me was I was able to find witnesses who were in their 90s. They were young men at the time. They watched their friends disappear into Auschwitz, never to return. And to listen to these men talk about watching their sweethearts, their childhood best friends go to the camps and on that first transport was really it really disturbing, but also just a tremendous opportunity to hear their testimony and to weave it into the survivor testimony. And And to, for me, one of the most important things about my book is I have a page of photographs of girls that didn't survive. It's tracking down and naming and giving us images, photographs, family photographs of girls that didn't survive who are, you know, 16, 17, 18. And that process started with Rena's Promise. And that was an extraordinary moment for me. I was in Slovakia the very first time. It was 2012. And Adela Gross was a beautiful redhead in Humenné, Slovakia, who Rena knew and saw. She saw her be selected for the gas. And she remembered her holding her head up and helping the other girls who were terrified. And the reason Rena really remembered Adela also was that Adela was healthy and she couldn't figure out why she was selected to die. Edith knew Adela. Adela was 18. And Edith actually ends up marrying Edith's sister-in-law, future sister-in-law, post-war, will be Adela's sister, who didn't go to Auschwitz, who was in hiding. And so when I'm in Slovakia, the Gross family, I left Adela's name on a memorial outside of the train station on a plaque. And they saw the name and they contacted me. Within 24 hours, I was in touch with the Gross family. And within a week, they had sent me a photograph of Adela Gross, which I had never seen in my entire life. And I had known the story for over 20 years. And suddenly I was like, oh my God, how many other stories are out there of families who lost these young women and they have no closure. And I have done my best to try and help families find closure and find the answers. The death records on women are almost, in 1942, are almost non-existent. We don't know if they were kept or if they were simply destroyed. So when I say that the tattooed numbers of 28,000 women in 1942 in Auschwitz, that's not how many women were in camp. Thousands and thousands had been taken to the gas. And, you know, I was questioned. It was very interesting. You know, one of the things I discovered in my research is witness testimony of a huge selection, which takes place in December 1942 on Shabbat Hanukkah. And that is the selection where Edith's sister dies. And Edith and Rena, completely unknown to each other, both told me 10,000 women died on that day. Then I get into the USC Shoah Foundation archives. Linda Brader tells me, Linda Breich, actually that's her married name, says 10,000 women died on that day. Rudolf Verba, who escaped from Auschwitz, says 10,000 young women died on that day. But if you look at the SS records, they say 2,000 died.
Our guest is Heather.
Who do we believe?
Yeah.
Who do we believe? People who were there, the people who were, the Nazis were very accurate with numbers, but they were not accurate with when it came to women. They knew better.
They know better, Heather? Because even this number, the 997, 999. You found that error in the archives, and you make the point the record keeping was lesser for women than for men. And what do you believe that was about? Was it about, I don't know, less value? What was it about? As you say, hiding, because perhaps the world would be more disgraced. Why were they, when they're so meticulous with other things, why were they so careless with this?
Well, I don't think they were careless at all. I mean, I do cover this in the book. Himmler was very, very into astrology and numerology. And I think the number 999 was, I actually had a historic astrologer take a look at the astrology of the first transport. And it trined, and I'm not an astrologer, so what I'm saying is, it's a chapter in the book. And it was quite hard for me to understand because I don't understand astrology. But anyway, the date of the transport, the time that the transport arrives is connected to a lunar eclipse that is trined in Heinrich Himmler's chart with his birth date. I mean, it's so to me, it seems so bizarre. But the Nazis were really into this. You know, they even had, you know, their own little department of mysticism, right? And they would, if astrologers didn't work for the Nazis, they put them in camps because they believed in the power of astrology so much. So I do think that this number, I can't prove it, but it's sort of a gut feeling. And when I got that gut feeling, I went and did the research. And my husband's also a writer. And he said, he was like, oh, don't do it, you know, don't go down that trail. But I wrote the chapter and he read it and he went, oh my God, you did it. You know, like, I believe you, you know? So I present it as, you know, we'll never know for sure, but there is enough evidence out there. And certainly, actually, Himmler's astrologer at the end of the war, that the SS used to joke, if you wanted to know, the Germans used to joke, if you wanted to know what Himmler was going to do, you asked his astrologer.
Heather June McAdam is our guest, 999, The Extraordinary Young Women of the First Official Jewish Transport to Auschwitz is her latest book. 28 minutes past 10, it is on 9 to noon. Well, what about Slovakia? I mean, how did this plan to sell these women happen?
Well, you know, the idea, the way it was presented to the assembly was that this is how we're, you know, it's all cloak and mirrors, right? First of all, what the fascists say is the problem with the economy is that there are too many poor Jews who aren't participating in the economy, right? So then they take away all their businesses so they can't participate in the economy. And they make it illegal for Jews to own businesses or homes or anything. And then, of course, they take away their property and their rights and their citizenship. The way it was sold to the assembly was that because we're getting rid of these people, our economy is going to be so much better, so we can pay to get rid of them. And then our economy is going to increase because we're going to take we're going to take all their wealth, except these people are really poor. Hello? they're impoverished and you want to get rid of them, but you're going to take everything they own and that's going to make you wealthy. So, you know, it in terms of logic, it makes no sense at all. But in terms of greed and money grubbing, it makes a lot of sense. And so that's how they sold it. And it wasn't until, I think, probably August 1942, I think it's correct, you know, assembly members started to go, wait a minute, this is costing us a lot of money. And they actually did stop their deportations in the latter part of August or September 1942. And not that there were all that many Jews left at that point. And President Tiso, who was the fascist in charge of the government and a Catholic priest, I will add, you know, they did go back and deport more Jews in 1944. It was only a pause, but it was sold as a way that this is good for the Slovak economy.
The first satellite, in fact, to deport its Jews, I think, Slovakia.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And I will say that, you know, the first time I went to Slovakia, I went on the anniversary of the first transport. It was the 70th anniversary. And the prime minister of Slovakia was there as part of the ceremonies and had issued a, you know, public statement from the government apologizing. Edith was actually there at the ceremony. I've been back several times since then. I've met ambassadors from Israel. I've met the prime minister. I've met the president of Slovakia. They, you know, Slovakia is doing their best to correct this past, and they do ceremonies on the anniversary, which I think are super, super important to keep this history to the forefront of their minds as well as our minds.
Why had it not been told before you, Heather, and these women?
I don't know. I mean, that's a really great question, and I get a lot of flack for saying that I think it's misogynistic, but that's what I think. I think, you know, these girls were uneducated, high school girls. They, you know, they weren't intellectuals. They weren't wealthy. Some of them came from wealthy families, but you know, in the scheme of things, girls aren't really important. And so, it's, I think they got swept under the rug. And I also think that there's the shame of it carries a huge amount of weight, that girls would be first and not men. And, you know, men want to protect their daughters, and that their daughters went first is a huge, huge blight. Edith used to say that her father, you know, he never got over the fact that, because he sent them to Auschwitz, he said to them, you have to go. It's the law. You have to go to work. I mean, he was obeying the law. He sent his girls to work. And he had no idea. And the absolute, I mean, how do you live with that? And many parents, I mean, Edith's parents did survive because her father was a glacier and worked on aircraft. So they were protected till the very end of the war when they had to go into hiding. But most of these young women's parents did not survive. And most of these young women, you know, we love to think the end of the war was it. And you know, big celebrations. Most of these girls came home and there was nobody left. They had nobody. You know, Margaret Kulick talks about arriving in her village, which was a super, super small village. And her family home is burnt down. There's nobody there. She walks back to the city, or the larger town, Strupkov, where, and she sits down and she just sobs because she doesn't, you know, she's come all the way from Auschwitz and there's nobody left in her, in the entire world. Nobody. I mean, how do you, she's 20 years old or 19. What do you do? And this young woman finds her crying and says to her, what's wrong? And she says, you know, I just came out of the camps. And she's a young Jewish woman and she has twin girls. And she says to her, I've lost my husband. I have twin daughters. You sleep in bed with one and I'll sleep in bed with the other. And she ended up living with her for like 2 years.
Heather, I recall interviewing the wonderful, amazing Edith Eger. And she said, my children are my revenge on Hitler. You tried to eliminate me, and my children are here and flourishing. And tell me about Rena and Edith. Rena, I think, at least had a family. Did they have families?
They did. Rena had four children. Edith only had one. And I will say, of all of these women, every single one of them had miscarriages. Many of them had trouble bearing children and were lucky to have one. Margaret Kulick, who I just spoke about, lost twins. And she said, you know, she was so her womb was so damaged from beatings and being kicked by SS. And one of a dear, dear friend of mine who lives in Melbourne, Australia, who I traveled to Slovakia with, her mother was sterilized in Auschwitz. And Orna was adopted, and she didn't find out she was adopted until after her mother passed away. Her mother wanted to keep that secret.
Heather, it's remarkable work. Thank you so much for your time today. Heather June McAdam, the second book, the recent book, is the 999, The Extraordinary Young Women of the First Official Jewish Transport to Auschwitz. And the earlier book we were discussing, published August, I think a couple of decades ago now, Rena's Promise, A Story of Two Sisters in Auschwitz.